The riders were indeed Sioux, wearing uniforms they had stripped from dead soldiers. Falcon knew at that moment that Tom Custer was dead, and the fact that some Injun was wearing his tunic probably meant that General Custer was dead as well, for he would never abandon his brother. The three men ran to the other side of the island, stooping over so low that they were concealed by the grass. But just as they reached the other side, they ran into a party of six-mounted Injuns.
Take them down! If we're gonna go, we need to go now!
Falcon led the way. He plunged into the river and worked his way to the far bank with O'Neill and DeRudio behind him. They quickly reached the other side of the river.
Who goes there?
Lieutenant DeRudio, Sergeant O'Neill, and Colonel McAllister.
McAllister, it's me, Varnum. This way.
Going toward Varnum, the three were once again reunited with the rest of the battalion. June 26, 1876. Reno's Redoubt. Until noon, the Sioux tried to take Reno's position, but they were beaten back with heavy losses every time. During the fighting, Falcon and Benteen moved back and forth along the line, exposing themselves to engine fire while inspiring the troops, and when necessary, supplying a little additional firepower of their own. Reno had taken up a position behind a breastwork constructed from some of the packs.
I'm convinced that Custer has gone on to effect this juncture with Terry. He's abandoned us to our fate.
I'm not so sure of that. It could be that he's like us, surrounded and unable to break out.
Falcon didn't share with Benteen his suspicion that not only was Custer's battalion surrounded, but that Custer himself might be dead.
You saw what happened when Weir tried to go to him. He was pushed back.
Yeah, I saw. But I do think Custer's joined with Terry.
If so, that would be a good thing. The combined troops could come to our relief.
But why didn't Custer support me as he said he would?
Only he can answer that.
I think we should leave.
Leave? We can't leave. One thing, we have too many wounded. They would slow us down.
We can leave our wounded. I don't want to do it, but we may have to sacrifice the few to save the money.
Reno, you don't mean that.
Reno took off his hat and ran his hand through his hair. Then he pinched his nose.
No, I don't mean that. I don't know what got into me for saying that. I'm sorry. Please forgive me.
There's nothing to forgive. It's been a rough 24 hours.
Then Falcon got the faintest whiff of smoke on the air. He turned and saw that the Injuns had set fire to the prairie grass. It soon became evident what the Injuns were doing, because in addition to the smoke, they also started the women and children milling about, dragging limbs behind them to stir up a large cloud of dust to mingle with the smoke. Within half an hour, the village, which had been seen easily before, was so obscured by smoke that the soldiers could see virtually nothing on the other side of the river.
Be on the alert, men! They may launch an attack from all the smoke and dust!
The men were tense as they waited apprehensively for the upcoming attack. By 7 o'clock that evening, though, their worries eased somewhat when they saw thousands of Injuns, warriors, squaws, and children, on horseback, being pulled by travois and walking, along with many more ponies and dogs. The village was no more, and the giant procession was leaving the site, winding its way up the slope on the far side of the valley, heading for the Bighorn Mountains.
Major, the Indians are gone. We need to get through to Custer.
No, Lieutenant Weir. It is Custer's responsibility to get through to us. I have no orders suggesting I join him.
Maybe not, but you do, Captain Benteen.
What do you mean by that?
Trumpeter Martin said that he had brought you a note from Custer. May I see it?
That note was for me, not you.
May I see it?
Benteen pulled the note from his shirt pocket and handed it to Weir.
Benteen, come on, Big Village. Be quick. W.W. Cook. P.S. Bring packs.
We'll wait here for Custer.
Reno stayed in position throughout the night, just to make certain the Injuns were gone. The next morning, with good water now available and the packs brought up, the men had a decent breakfast of bacon, hard bread, and coffee. Not having heard from Custer throughout the day and the previous night, Benteen and Reno had now come around to Weir's idea, and they were making plans to send at least one troop forward to make contact with Custer. Since Weir had tried unsuccessfully 2 days earlier, they agreed that his troop would be the one that would push forward.
Major Reno, troops are coming.
Falcon pointed to a column of blue approaching from some distance.
It has to be Custer.
Major, you might want to check this out. When we were on the island, we saw what we thought were soldiers, but it turned out to be Indians wearing uniforms they had taken off the dead.
Yes. Yes. Yes, you might be right. I need a couple of volunteers to ride out and see.
I'll go.
So will I.
Falcon and Varnum mounted horses, then galloped out to meet the advancing party. It turned out to be General Terry.
Gentlemen, where's Custer?
General, that's the same question we were about to ask you.
June 28th, 1876. Custer Battlefield. Approaching the battlefield, the first thing Falcon saw were a lot of white objects lying on the ground. At first, he was confused as to what they were. Then he realized he was looking at bodies. Almost to a man, the soldiers had been stripped naked, and their bodies now lay bloating in the sun. There was an eerie quiet among the men as they moved, thunderstruck, across the battlefield. Jimmy Calhoun was found exactly where he should have been, in position behind his men, who were arrayed in proper skirmish formation. Tom Custer was lying on his face. Tom Custer was the most mutilated of all. He'd been scalped, his skull had been crushed by war clubs, his body bristled with dozens of arrows, and his heart had been cut out. Keogh had not been mutilated, nor had his crucifix been taken. General Custer was found on the highest point of the field, sitting, not lying, between two dead soldiers, his arm resting on top of one of the corpses. Other than the fact that he had been stripped naked, Custer's body was undisturbed.
I found all the officers but one. General Custer, Tom Custer, Keogh, Cook, Calhoun, Riley, Crittenden, Smith, Porter, and Sturgis, also young Boston Custer, and Audie Reed.
As the burial detail went about its sad and grisly task, Falcon returned to the site of Reno's redoubt. There, he saw the men busily constructing litters for the wounded. 52 men had been wounded in the 2-day fight, and there was but one doctor left alive to treat them. Dr. H.R. Porter was a civilian, and Dr. DeWolf had remained with Reno's battalion when Custer divided his command. Dr. DeWolf had been killed trying to climb the bank when the battalion retreated from its first position, leaving Porter alone to deal with the wounded.
We have quite a few miles to cover. I think we should construct travois. It would be faster and easier than having to carry them.
Have you ever ridden on a travois, Major?
No, I haven't, but I've certainly seen the Indians use them.
A travois is fine if you're going over smooth, level ground. But if you're traveling over rough and rocky ground like the ground we passed over on the way to this point, it can be a very rough ride. And for a wounded man, it can be extremely painful.
All right. I see no reason to subject these men to any further discomfort. We will use stretchers.
June 29th, 1876. The far west, at the mouth of the Little Bighorn. After a long, slow, and difficult march, the remnants of the 7th Cavalry, carrying their wounded on stretchers, finally reached the steamboat far west. But because General Terry had sent a dispatch rider ahead, by the time they arrived, preparations were already underway to receive the wounded. Long grass had been pulled from the banks of the river and laid to a thickness of several inches on the deck of the boat. Heavy tarpaulins were spread over the grass to create one large mattress, and on that mattress the wounded soldiers were carefully and gently laid in rows, leaving enough separation to allow Dr. Porter to move through them. Comanche was placed in the stern of the boat, and a couple of troopers were detailed to look after him. As preparations were being made to get underway, Major Reno and Captain Benteen asked Falcon to come to Reno's tent. Reno had already established himself as the new commander, having marked his tent with a regimental flag. He had also reissued sabers, and both he and Benteen were wearing them when Falcon answered the summons.
Well, Mr. McAllister, Captain Benteen and I have talked it over, and we think it would be better if you returned to Fort Lincoln on the steamer.
You're in command, Major. I'll do whatever you want.
It's just that, well, Custer always referred to you as a colonel, and while you are a lieutenant colonel in the Colorado Guard, you have no authority or military standing within the 7th Cavalry.
Nor have I ever assumed as much.
I'm not saying you have, but many of the men heard Custer referring to you as a colonel, and they might not understand the nuances. We've been through a very difficult campaign. I cannot afford to have the troopers confused as to who is in command.
What the Major is saying is he feels his authority would be threatened by your presence. If you're on the boat, that won't be a problem.
I understand. Of course, I'll be more than pleased to return on the steamer.
Good. Perhaps you could do something else for me.
Benteen took an envelope from his pocket.
And going through my mail, I found this letter from General Custer to Mrs. Custer. It's going to be difficult for her to receive this letter after her husband's already dead. You know her, so perhaps it'd be easier for her to get it from you.
Yeah, I think it might be easier for her. That is very thoughtful of you, Captain.
Well, I think it's well known I did not like Custer, but I hold no animosity towards his widow.
Falcon accepted the letter, then with a nod toward the two officers, he left the headquarters tent to look up Lieutenant Varnum. Falcon found Varnum overseeing the reshoeing of one of the horses.
I'm going back on the boat.
I'm not surprised. I overheard Reno and Benteen talking about it. I wish they felt as threatened by me. I wouldn't mind an easy ride back on the boat.
June 30th, 1876, on board the Far West. Dawn had just broken when Captain Grant Marsh gave the order to cast off the lines. Falcon overheard General Terry tell Marsh to use every skill at his command to make the trip back to Fort Lincoln as fast as was humanly possible. The boat was draped in black, and the flag was at half-staff as Captain Grant Marsh blew the whistle and started downstream. At 11 o'clock on the night of July 4th, the Far West tied down at the wharf in Bismarck, within sight of Fort Lincoln. It had made a journey of 1,000 miles in just 54 hours. Falcon walked up to the wheelhouse where Marsh and Campbell were both sitting down on a cushioned bench.
Captain Marsh, Mr. Campbell, what the two of you have just done will go down in the history books to be remembered forever.
Falcon pointed to the deck, where already arrangements were being made to take the men off the boat and get them to a hospital.
These men owe you their lives, and America owes you its respect.
That's all well and good, Falcon, but right now I would trade it all for a bunk and a pillow.
June 25th, 1927, McAllister, Colorado. Falcon was quiet for a moment, letting the impact of his story sink in.
If I may, I would like to take up where you left off and finish the story.
Yes, please do.
As you remember, the day before had been Independence Day, and we had a gala celebration on the post. The band played patriotic songs, fireworks were set off, and we had a dance which, as the commander's wife, I attended, even though my heart was not in it. Because, as you know, I had the most terrible premonition throughout the entire time my dear husband was on the scout. As Falcon said, the Far West docked at Bismarck at 11 o'clock on the night of July 4th.
July 5th, 1876, Fort Lincoln, Dakota Territory. It was 7 a.m., and Libby, her sister-in-law Maggie, and her house guest Lorena were having breakfast when the maid told Libby there was someone in the living room wanting to speak to her.
Goodness, who wants to talk to me at this hour?
No doubt some soldier's wife with a problem that she thinks only you can solve.
Don't be that way, dear. We're all in the same boat out here, especially now.
You're right. I'm sorry.
No need to apologize. I know you didn't mean anything hateful.
The smile was still on Libby's lips as she stepped into the living room. But when she saw Captain McCaskill, Lieutenant Gurley and Dr. Middleton, all standing together. The smile disappeared. Captain McCaskill stepped forward solemnly.
Mrs. Custer, I am sorry to have to tell you this.
Oh, Libby, what is it?
Libby reached out and took Lorena by the hand, squeezing it tightly.
Please, Captain, go on.
I have a dispatch that I received from General Terry last night. It might be best if I just read the report. It is my painful duty to report that on the 25th of June, a great disaster overtook General Custer and the troops under his command. At 12 o'clock of the 22nd, he started with his whole regiment and a strong detachment of scouts and guides from the mouth of the Rosebud. Proceeding up that river about 20 miles, he struck a very heavy Indian trail, which had previously been discovered, and pursuing it, found that it led, as it was supposed that it would lead, to the Little Bighorn River. Here he found a village of almost unlimited extent, and at once attacked it
with that portion of his command which was immediately at hand. Major Reno, with three companies, A, G, and M, of the regiment, was sent into the valley of the stream at the point where the trail struck it. General Custer, with five companies, C, E, F, I, and L, attempted to enter about 3 miles lower down. Reno forded the river, charged down its left bank, and fought on foot until finally, completely overwhelmed by numbers, he was compelled to mount and recross the river and seek a refuge on the high bluffs which overlooked its right bank. Just as he recrossed, Captain Benteen, who, with three companies, D, H, and K, was some 2 miles to the left of Reno when the action commenced, but who had been ordered by General Custer to return, came to the river, and rightly concluding that it was useless for his force to attempt to renew the fight in the valley, he joined Reno on the bluffs. Captain McDougall, with his company, B, was at first some distance in the rear with a train of pack mules. He also came up to Reno. Soon, this united force was nearly surrounded by Indians, many of whom, armed with rifles, occupied positions which commanded the ground held by the cavalry, ground from which there was no escape. Rifle pits were dug, and the fight was maintained, though with heavy loss, from about 2:30 of the 25th till 6:00 of the 26th, when the Indians withdrew from the valley, taking with them their village. Of the movements of General Custer and the five companies under his immediate command, scarcely anything is known from those who witnessed them.
Please, Captain, continue.
Yes, ma'am. No officer or soldier who accompanied him has yet been found alive. His trail from the point where Reno crossed the stream passes along and in the rear of the crest of the bluffs on the right bank for nearly or quite 3 miles. Then it comes down the bank of the river, but at once diverges from it, as if he had unsuccessfully attempted to cross, then turns upon itself, almost completing a circle, and closes. It is marked by the remains of his officers and men and the bodies of his horses.
Some of them strewn along the path, others heaped where halts appeared to have been made. There is abundant evidence that a gallant resistance was offered by the troops, but they were beset on all sides by overpowering numbers. The officers known to be killed are General Custer, Captains Keogh, Yates, and Custer, and Lieutenants Cook, Smith, McIntosh, Calhoun, Porter, Hudson, Sturgis, and Riley of the cavalry. Lieutenant Crittenden of the 12th Infantry, along with Acting Assistant Surgeon D.E. Wolfe, Lieutenant Harrington of the cavalry, and Assistant Surgeon Lord, are missing. Captain Benteen and Lieutenant Varnum of the cavalry are slightly wounded. Mr. B. Custer, a brother, and Mr. Reed, a nephew of General Custer,
were with him and were killed. No other officers than those whom I have named are among the killed, wounded, and missing. Mrs. Custer, is there anything I can do for you?
Yes. Would you hand me my shawl, please? I've taken a chill.
The three men, all of whom were already sweating, for the day had dawned quite warm, looked at each other. Then Captain McCaskill got the shawl and wrapped it around her shoulders. Then, turning, he, Dr. Middleton, and Lieutenant Gurley started to leave.
Captain, wait. There are many wives who will have to be informed. Please, let me go with you.
Libby Custer followed Captain McCaskill and his notification team, first to the officers' quarters to inform their wives, then down to Laundress Row to inform the wives of the enlisted men. She stood by as one by one they were told, offered what solace she could, even as her own heart was broken. She knew this was exactly what her husband would have wanted. It was just afternoon when Libby returned to the commandant's quarters. Mary had lunch prepared, but neither Libby, Maggie, nor Lorena felt like eating. Libby looked around the house, at the furniture that she and Custer had hauled all over the country, at the hunting trophies Custer had bagged, at the table where Custer sat to write his galaxy articles, at the piano, and at the photos hanging from the picture rail, her favorite of Custer and one of General Sheridan. The home was large and comfortable, and in no place she had ever been had she been more comfortable. But this was the commandant's house, and Brevet General G.A. Custer was no longer the commandant. She was no longer the commandant's wife, and as a matter of fact, she was no longer an army wife. Other wives, upon learning of the untimely death of their husband, would at least have the comfort of their own home until they recovered. She would not. As of this moment, Libby Custer was not the resident of this house. She was merely a visitor, someone who would be forced to leave not only this house, but the entire army. As Libby was contemplating the terrible turn of fate that had befallen her, Falcon was shown in by Mary.
Oh, Colonel McAllister!
Falcon embraced Libby and held her for a long moment. Looking around, Falcon saw Lorena sitting in a chair near the wall.
Where's Maggie?
She is taken to her bed. This has been terribly hard on her, too.
Yeah, I imagine it has.
Did you see Tom before this all happened?
Yeah, and he had a message for you.
A message? What sort of message?
He said for me to tell you that he thought it might have worked.
He said that?
Yeah.
I mean, he said it exactly that way, that he thought it might have worked?
Yeah, I think Tom had a premonition. That was his way of wanting me to tell you that he loved you.
Oh, thank you, Falcon. Thank you for telling me that.
Yes, ma'am. Libby, I have the general's last letter for you, when you're up to reading it. Do you want it now?
Yes. Oh, please, do give it to me now.
June 25th, 1927, McAllister, Colorado. Once more, Libby lifted the handkerchief to her eyes and dabbed at the tears. By now, though, the handkerchief was soaked, and young Rosie brought a new, clean, and dry one to her.
Thank you, darling. Falcon, I have the letter that you brought me that terrible day. Would you like me to read it?
Yeah, please do.
Libby removed an envelope from her purse and pulled out a well-worn and obviously often read letter.
My darling, I have but a few moments to write as we start at 12, and I have my hands full of preparations for the scout. Do not be anxious about me. You would be surprised how closely I obey your instructions about keeping with the column. I hope to have a good report to send you by the next mail.
A success will start us all toward Lincoln. I send you an extract from General Terry's official order, knowing how keenly you appreciate words of commendation and confidence in your dear beau. It is, of course, impossible to give you any definite instructions in regard to this movement, and, were it not impossible to do so, the department commander places too much confidence in your zeal, energy, and ability to impose on you precise orders which might hamper your action when nearly in contact with the enemy. Your devoted boy, Autie.
Libby looked up after finishing the letter, and even though it was over 50 years later, her eyes glistened with tears.
I also have the last letter I wrote to him, and as this letter didn't get there until it was too late, he never read it. Would you like to hear it as well?
Yeah, I'd very much like to hear it.
My darling Beau, I feel so badly I was not on board the boat, but I might have found myself so conspicuous on the steamer if you had gone off on a scout. I cannot but feel the greatest apprehensions for you on this dangerous scout. Oh, Autie, if you return without bad news, the worst of the summer will be over. The papers told last night of a small skirmish between General Crook's cavalry and the Indians. They called it a fight. The Indians were very bold. They don't seem afraid of anything. The Belknap case is again postponed. Of course, that worries me. The prosecution is going to call you as a witness. Politicians will try to make something out of you for their own selfish ends. But I hear you say, don't cross bridges till you come to them. I am perfectly delighted with your Galaxy War article, but I wish you had not spoken for McClellan so freely. Still, I don't see how you could have consistently given your opinions of the war without giving him his just due. It finishes Mr. Chandler as a friend, I fear. And for that, I am sorry, as he can be a very tenacious enemy, and of late has been only a passive friend. I honestly think you would be better off with some policy with such powerful enemies. A cautious wife is a great bore, isn't she, Autie? You improve every time you write. There is nothing like this McClellan article for smoothness of style. I have this month's Galaxy with the Yellowstone article. How fortunate you had left it with Mr. Sheldon. I am anxious about the one you sent by the Buford mail. The mail was dropped in the Yellowstone, and they must have attempted to dry it before the fire, for all our letters are scorched. Maggie's to Jim had been re-enveloped at Buford. I think to ride as you do and write is wonderful. Nothing daunts you in your wish to improve. I wish your lines had fallen among literary friends. And yet, Autie, I wouldn't have you anything but a soldier. It is the hottest day of the season, yet cold chills are running up and down my back at your description of the Yellowstone fight. I am glad you gave Tom his due. Of course you appreciate his valor as a soldier, yet you do not want to be puffing your own family. Mother will be pleased for Tommy. Your mention of him would satisfy the most exacting of mothers. I cannot but commend your commendation of General Stanley. To ignore injury and praise what is praiseworthy is the highest form of nobility. I could not do it. My soul is too small to forgive. I know you have a gift for finding roads, but how nice of General Terry to acknowledge your skill and perseverance that way. Maggie and Lorena are entertaining Dr. X and Mr. G in the parlor. I went in for manners, but was too heavy-hearted to stay. Mr. B called. He told me of Button's resignation because Grant treated him unfairly, but it was withheld till after the convention. The wildflowers are a revelation. Almost the first sweet-scented I have ever known. The house is full of bouquets. With your bright future and the knowledge that you are positive use to your day and generation, do you not see that your life is precious on that account? And not only because an idolizing wife could not live without you. I shall go to bed and dream of my dear Beau. Libby. As I said, he never got to read this letter. It was returned to me unopened by...
Libby paused for a moment, then glanced over at Falcon.
You brought it back to me, didn't you?
You brought this one to me the same time you brought Otis' letter to me.
Yes, ma'am.
I know it is foolish to cry after all these years.
It ain't foolish at all.
What did you do next, Mrs. Custer?
May I answer that, Libby?
Yes, if you wish.
Rosie, Libby Custer has become a very successful writer, writing not only about General Custer, but other books, as well as articles for newspapers and magazines. She writes about public affairs, is considered an expert on art, the opera, and ballet. And she is a lecturer, too. She talks about her husband, also about the social and economic status of women. For someone who is left only with a widow's pension of $30 per month, Libby has overcome great odds because she is forceful and strong. She is also a very shrewd investor who has become quite prosperous and has traveled in England, Germany, Egypt, Turkey, China, and Japan. And I am proud to say that she is not only a fellow writer, she is my friend.
Oh, that is wonderful, but...
But what, dear?
Whatever happened to the other lady? To Lorena?
I'm afraid I don't know.
Oh. We kept in touch for a while. Lorena returned to Washington and married an English diplomat. When his assignment to Washington was over, they moved to England.
Does she live there now?
No, dear. She and her husband were coming to America for a visit. They were on the Titanic. Lorena survived, but her husband went down with the ship.
Oh, that's awful. She was in love with two men and both of them died. I wonder, where is she now?
She's in St. Louis, Missouri.
Zane Grey saw that Rosie was about to ask Falcon about Lorena, and he sensed that Falcon did not want to talk about her. He asked a question of his own.
Falcon, whatever happened to Cleet Harris, Jim Garron, and Jay Bryans, the men who stole the Gatling guns? Did you ever run across them again?
Oh, yeah. I ran across them again.
May 1877, Green River, Wyoming Territory. It had been a year since Cleet Harris, Jim Garron, and Jay Bryans made good their escape from Montana, leaving just before the climactic battle. They had been able to take advantage of the fact that the Injuns were preparing to meet Custer and that the Army was preparing to meet the Injuns. They were unmolested as they left the territory. After Potter escaped from the post stockade, he left Colorado and met with Harris and the others in Cheyenne, Wyoming. There, they divided the money, which turned out to be over $5,000. Then each went on their own way. But high living during the year just passed, including gambling, liquor, and women, had taken all the money. It was Harris who got the three of them together with a plan that would, in his words, make us rich again. Now the three were gathered in a thicket of willow trees just outside the town of Green River, Wyoming. It was still early in the morning, and from there they could not only see the town, they could hear the sounds of a beginning day of commerce.
All right. Do both of you know exactly what to do?
What's there to know, Harris? We ride into town, stop in front of the bank, go in, get the money, and ride out.
There's a little more to it than that. Garron, you stay outside with the horses. I want them there when we come out, and I mean I want them there. If we have to leave fast and I see you riding off, I swear I will shoot you myself.
I'll be there.
And Bryans, you go in with me. We won't shoot anyone unless we have to, but if we have to, don't stand there with your thumb up your ass. If you hesitate, even for a moment, more than likely you're the one that's going to wind up getting shot. You follow me?
Don't worry, I know what to do.
All right. Let's ride into town. Let's not all go in together. I'll go first, and Garron, you wait 5 or 10 minutes, and you come in. Bryans, you come in after that. We'll all sort of meet up in front of the bank. That way nobody will see us all together until it's too late for anyone to do anything about it. You boys ready?
I'm ready.
Yeah.
All right, let's do it.
Harris rode in first. He stopped in front of the apothecary just across the street from the bank. He dismounted, then lifted his horse's left forepaw, pretending to examine the shoe. Looking up, he saw Bryans and Garron riding into town as well, and though they weren't exactly together, they were close enough that Harris thought that they should be further separated. All three waited at various places up and down the street until the bank opened. As soon as someone inside the bank turned around the sign reading open, the three men came together. Garen remained in his saddle. Harris and Bryans handed him their reins, then both men went inside the bank. There were no customers yet, and the teller, who had just posted the open sign, was walking around to the teller cage. He smiled at Harris and Bryans.
Good morning, gentlemen. Up bright and early, I see.
Yeah, well, you know what they say. The early bird gets the worm. Or in this case, the early bird gets the money.
Oh, my.
Empty the safe.
Bryans went back to the door and turned the sign around so that once again it indicated the bank was closed. The teller was so frightened that his hands were shaking visibly as he opened the safe. He took out a stack of bills and held them out toward Harris.
Here, Harris, make him put the money in this bag.
Oh, Bryans, you dumb bastard, you just said my name.
The teller had just finished filling the sack when a new customer came into the bank.
Hey, Johnny, you forgot to turn the sign around. It says you're still closed. I turn it back. Oh my God, bank robbery!
The man turned to go back outside, but before he could get through the door, Bryans leveled his pistol.
Oh, let's get out of here!
With Harris clutching the now filled sack of money, the two men ran out of the bank, stepping over the customer's body. The horses had been startled by the sound of the gunshot, making it difficult for Garen to control them.
Garen, get the goddamn horses ready! We gotta ride!
I'm trying!
After one more turn, Garen managed to quiet the horses. Then he held out the reins so Harris and Bryans could swing into the saddle.
Bank robbery! The bank's been robbed!
Shoot up the town! Keep their goddamn heads down!
The shooting had the desired effect, and those who had come out of the stores and buildings to see what was going on now rushed back inside. Unharmed, the three men galloped out of town. Nobody chased them. Everybody's attention was drawn to the schoolyard. There, the school farm, two small children lay dead. When Falcon took the train to Green River, Wyoming, he carried with him a copy of the newspaper he had read 2 days earlier. The newspaper had the story of a bank robbery that had taken place in Green River a week earlier. Three men had robbed the bank, and the teller had heard all three names called. The names were Harris, Bryans, and Garen. Falcon had not been specifically looking for the three men in the year since the Custer massacre. There had been other things to keep him occupied. But he hadn't forgotten about them. And when he heard the three names together, he knew this was them. When he stepped down from the train, he saw a wanted poster attached to the front wall of the depot.
Wanted for bank robbery and murder. Dead or alive. Harrison, Garen, Bryans. 500 for each man. See Sheriff Mickey Dancer, Green River, Wyoming Territory.
When Falcon pushed the door open to the sheriff's office a short time later, he saw two men playing checkers. One player inside a jail cell, the other sitting on a stool just outside the cell bars.
Is Sheriff Dancer here?
I'm Sheriff Dancer. What can I do for you?
I'm here to talk to you about Cleet Harris, Jim Garen, and Jay Bryans.
Cleet, Jim, and Jay, huh? Those are their first names, are they?
Yeah.
Yeah, we never got their first names. Nobody in town has ever seen any of them before. Only way we got their last names is because they were dumb enough to use them. How do you know them?
I've been looking for them for over a year.
You a lawman?
Nope.
Bounty hunter, then?
No. This here's personal.
Personal?
Yeah.
How personal?
These three men stole some guns that I was responsible for. They sold those guns to the Sioux. Sue used those guns against Custer.
You say you were responsible for the guns?
Yeah.
How do you know they were used against Custer?
Because I was with Custer at his last fight.
What?
Actually, I was with Reno.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I forgot about the ones with Reno. Well, I can see how you might take something like that real personal. And when you get right down to it, I don't reckon it makes no never mind who finds him or why, as long as the sons of bitches get what's coming to them.
You have any leads on him?
I thought I did, but it didn't pan out. One of the freight wagon drivers said he thought he saw one of the men over in Bitter Creek. But when I wired the city marshal over there, he checked on it, came up empty. I figured maybe Harley did see him, but the fella had passed on through. Only Harley's been back to Bitter Creek twice, and he claims to have seen him both times. Then the other day, the stagecoach driver said he seen one of the men over there, too.
Did you get in touch with the marshal again?
Yeah, I did, and he said he'd keep an eye out for him.
You said the freight wagon driver's name was Harley?
Yeah, Harley Barnes. Stagecoach driver's name is Norman Case.
Do you think they talked to me?
Well, I expect they would, although Case is more than likely out on the run right now. But you can probably find Harley down at the freight office. Tell him I sent you.
All right, thanks. And thanks for the information.
Falcon went back outside and walked down to the freight office that was at the far end of the street. He came up on a rather large man who was sitting on an upturned barrel, packing grease into the hub of the removed wheel.
Would you be Harley Barnes?
Yes, sir. Who might you be?
Falcon McAllister.
The Falcon McAllister? I've heard of you, mister. What can I do for you?
I understand you saw one of the men who robbed the bank over in Bitter Creek.
Hell, I've seen all three of them over there. Couple of times.
How do you know it was him?
Because I was sitting in this very wagon right out front when they come galloping down the street shooting and yelling like fiends from hell. They passed right in front of me, no more than 10, 12 feet away.
Sheriff Dancer said the city marshal over in Bitter Creek says he hasn't seen him.
Yeah? Well, the marshal over in Bitter Creek is lying, because I seen him standing right next to one of them in the saloon.
Did you point that out to the marshal?
No, they was taking on like they was just real good friends. I figured he not only wouldn't believe me, it could be dangerous to even mention it.
Well, you may be right. Mr. Barnes, I thank you for your information. I'm going to go over there and have a look around myself.
What are you going to do if you find him?
I'm going to kill him.
Falcon McAllister was carrying a small grip with him when he stepped into the Yellow Dog Saloon after detraining in Bitter Creek. The saloon was doing a brisk business, and there were more people coming into the place even as Falcon stepped over to put his back to the wall while he surveyed the room. A chair opened up at a poker game. He walked over to the table.
Howdy. Mind if I join you, gentlemen?
You're welcome, mister. The name is Charlie Knox. I own the hardware store here. This is Beckworth. He owns the livery. And this is Zell. He runs the newspaper.
Falcon played three hands with him, winning one and losing two. It was always good to ease into the conversation, so he hadn't asked any questions and he hadn't picked up on any specific information. He was just trying to formulate how to get the information he needed when he overheard something from one of the other tables that caught his attention.
I told Custer to take them Gatling guns. Stood right there and told him that just before he took his last ride. He didn't listen to me. No, sir, he didn't listen at all.
Falcon turned in his seat to get a look at the man who was talking.
Don't pay no attention to him. He's told that story more than a dozen times, and he changes it most every time. It's surprising Stevens can even find anyone to listen to his stories anymore.
What'd you say his name was?
Stevens.
It isn't Stevens.
It isn't?
No, sir. His name is Cleet Harris. He and two other men, Jim Guerin and Jay Bryans, are wanted back in Green River for murder and robbery.
Damn. I heard about that. You say there was three of them?
Yeah.
That sort of fits. Stevens, or whatever his real name is, runs with a couple of other galoots. And they all three got to town about the same time. Now that I think on it, they don't none of them work, far as I can tell. But they always seem to have money. And the thing is, they are great friends with Clayton.
Who's Clayton?
He's the city marshal. That's funny. If these here galoots are the ones you say they are, why, I wonder why Mr. Clayton is so friendly with them.
Excuse me, gents. Yeah.
I was right there with Custer when all the fighting commenced. I seen him go down. Last one to go down, he was, except for me.
You're lying.
What did you say to me, mister?
I said you're lying. And while I don't normally care whether a man lies or not, your lies are stealing honor from good men. And I won't allow that.
You won't allow it?
That's right, I won't allow it. You're Cleet Harris, ain't you?
What? My name's Bart Stevens.
I know who you are, Harris, and you know who I am. You were the foreman of the jury that let Garin off. Later, you, Garin Brines, and Richland sold Gatling guns to the Indians.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Take your gun out real slow and drop it. We're gonna go see the marshal.
No need to go anywhere to find me. I'm here. McAllister.
Potter.
Graham Potter had been the civilian telegrapher back at Fort Junction. It was Potter's telegram that had set up the operation in which Falcon's old friend, Sergeant Major O'Leary, and four others had been killed.
I'm the law here, McAllister. Boys, if you want to know the truth, this here's Falcon McAllister. He was the commanding officer of the Colorado Home Guard. Only he stole rifles and Gatling guns from his own regiment and sold them to the Indians. If there's any arresting to be done, I'll be doing it.
Not today. Not ever. You're the one who set it up so Harris could take the guns. So as far as I'm concerned, you're as guilty as Harris, Garin, and Brines are. I intend to put you into your own jail until we can get the sheriff here.
There's two of us. There's only one of you.
That's all right. I got enough bullets for both of you.
You're crazy if you think you can come into my town and start making wild claims like that.
I would appreciate it, Potter, if you and Harris would both just take your guns out real slow.
Well, now, I don't plan to do that, McAllister.
Falcon cut a quick glance toward the bar, and when he did, he saw in the mirror why Potter was grinning. Standing at the railing of the upstairs landing were Brines and Garin. Both of them were pointing their pistols at Falcon. Suddenly, Falcon launched himself to his left, pulling his pistol and diving to the floor as he did so. Brines and Garin's both missed. Falcon lifted his pistol. No! He hit Brines between the eyes. Garin caught a bullet in his stomach and fell forward. Suddenly, Falcon felt the sting of a bullet nicking his left arm. He quickly rolled over and got Harris in his sights.
You go to hell, McAllister.
After you, Potter.
June 25th, 1927, McAllister, Colorado. Falcon walked back out to the front of his house with Zane Gray and Libby Custer. He stood alongside Zane Gray's Packard automobile.
My friend, that was quite a story. I do wish you would let me write it.
Well, I'd rather you not.
Don't worry. I gave you my word that I wouldn't, and I won't. Even at your age, I don't think I would want to cross you.
At my age, I depend upon the integrity of men who give me their word.
Among men of good faith, that is all that is needed. Well, Libby, you were a little concerned about your schedule. It looks like we'll have plenty of time to get you to the train.
Yes, and I'm so glad I came. You know, Falcon, after my Audi, there never was another man for me. But if there had been, well, goodbye, my dear old friend.
Goodbye, Libby.
Falcon walked back up onto the porch and stood there as the Packard drove away.
Hey, Grandpa, what did Mrs. Custer mean when she said there had never been another man for her? But if there had been...
Oh, she didn't mean nothing by it, darling.
You know what I think? I think she was flirting with you.
Do you now?
Bloodshed of Eagles is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2009, William W. Johnstone. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation. All rights reserved. With performances by Mort Shelby, David Coyne, Terrence Aselford, Michael Glenn, Thomas Penny, Andy Clements, Christopher Graybill, Stephen Carpenter, Tim Getman, Elizabeth Jernigan, Richard Rowan, James Lewis, Colleen Delaney, Eric Messner, Michael John Casey, Casey Platt, Ken Jackson, Johan Detweiler, James Konacek, Scott McCormick, Nanette Savard, Jonathan Watkins, Dylan Lynch, and Joe Brack. Additional Boot Hill Boys by the Dead Giveaways. Directed by Bob Supan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Brian Patton. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. Musical score by Brian Patton and Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Bloodshed of Eagles, read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com. And be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's Smoke Jensen, The Mountain Man, The First Mountain Man, Blood Bond, The Last Gunfighter, and Sidewinder series, available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations. Two isolated groups of surviving Russians attempt to join forces to overcome John Rourke and his German allies in a race to gain access to a nuclear arsenal in China.
If whoever has taken over the leadership of Karamazov's army should find the remainder of the Chinese nuclear arsenal or effect some sort of treaty with the Soviet forces based in the Pacific and thereby obtain nuclear weapons, it is unthinkable.
The unthinkable became reality 5 centuries before. It doesn't mean undoable anymore, Captain.
Natalia and the Rourke family face assassination squads in China and an attack on their stronghold in Georgia.
There is no need for your men to die. They can walk out of here alive and unmolested. If you order them to withdraw before they take the lives of my family, you can join them or stay and fight me. Whatever you wish.
We all came, Dr. Rourke, knowing we would never leave.
What the hell are they doing?
Assaulting the retreat, it appears.
Why? And who are they?
They must be planning to plant explosive charges where they think the main entrance is.
Could conventional explosives do anything?
No location is completely insusceptible to explosive damage if the job is done correctly.
Weil! Etwas ist hier falsch!
You're German, Paul.
German? But...
we'll discuss it later.
Horst! Get down!
Eden Base members Halverson and Kuranami must find safe harbor with Wolfgang Mann's forces or face murder charges from Commander Dodd.
Colonel Mann, how dare you hold this man and his female accomplice in total defiance of my request? Kuranami is subject to the military discipline of Eden Base Command. He is mine, and so is his accomplice, Dr. Halverson.
It would appear that none of the Eden personnel are unaccounted for, yet you insist that the lieutenant has murdered someone. Who might these dead be? German nationals who are enemies of the state? Criminals with whom you, perhaps, sympathize?
I don't have to take your insults, Colonel.
Nor do I have to return Lieutenant Kuranami and his fiancée, the Fräulein Doctor.
Where the rocks narrow up ahead, it's a good spot for an ambush. The tire! Get out of there! We're clear! Get out of there!
John!
The tire!
John!
Natalia! Natalia! Damn it!
John!
Hold on, sweetheart.
A haunting past, a harrowing future, and betrayal from within all challenge John Rourke's skills in Survivalist Number 16, The Arsenal, in Graphic Audio.
From the author of the critically acclaimed Elantris comes a beautifully crafted tale of dark intrigue, bitter rivalries, and powerful magic. In order to save his kingdom of Idris from certain annihilation, King Dedalan must honor a treaty made long ago. He must send his oldest daughter to marry Suzabron, the God King of Alondrin.
War is coming, Your Majesty. They will attack.
If we send her, Yarda, we send her to her death.
Sending Vivenna is a poor plan, but it's our only plan.
Father, if we break this treaty, it will mean war. I am prepared to sacrifice for our people.
Lord God of Colors, forgive me. Vivenna, you will not go to wed the tyrant god of our enemies. I'm sending Ciri to your place.
Ciri, the youngest daughter of King Dedalan, soon finds herself plunged into a world of intrigue and politics. inhabited by undead gods and zombie armies. And she quickly learns that there is a darkness spreading through the highest order of Halandrin, threatening to consume all she loves.
Vessel, doing your duty as the vessel was the danger.
You have to tell me something.
You must not bear him a child. That is the danger. This all, everything here in the palace, is not what it appears to be.
Cursed with a lecherous form of magic which causes her to feed off the souls of the living, Princess Vivenna battles to save the life of her sister and prevent the war engine of Halandrin from crushing her homeland.
Your father and Lemix were right. The Halandrin have everything to lose by not attacking you.
I'm not going to become an Awakener, Dim. I might turn a blind eye toward that lifeless for now, but I will not awaken.
In the Court of the Gods, the highest authority in all of Halandrin, Lightsong the Bold, resurrected hero of ages since past, must come to grips with his newfound immortality as he struggles to unlock the dark secret of the Pantheon of Gods and their unstoppable armies of the undead.
What do they want of me, Larimar? Do they really think I'll do it? Lightsong the Selfish. Do they really think I'd give my life for one of them?
You offer hope, Your Grace. A last, unlikely hope.
And if they're wrong, I have no desire to die. And why should it be otherwise? I mean, we have to die to heal one of them. We're gods to them only until they kill us.
And the key to halting the baying hounds of war may lie in the hands of the one man who wants to watch the world burn. Vasher, the Warbreaker.
Yeah. Are you here to frame me?
No, Vahir. I'm here to kill you.
Don't miss Brandon Sanderson's high fantasy masterpiece, Warbreaker. Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include five books of a series, available only at www.graphicaudio.net.